You're listening to 1001 Album Club, where each episode we discuss a different album from Robert Emery's book, 1001 Albums Was Here Before You Die. This episode, we'll be talking about My Bloody Valentine, Loveless. In the room, I have Rob.
My dear God, it's full of stars.
And John.
Woo!
And on the line, I have Ben.
Sick.
Loveless is the second studio album by the Irish-English rock band My Bloody Valentine. It was released on the 4th of November, 1991, in the UK by Creation Records and the US by Sire Records. The producer was Kevin Shields. And the genre is shoegaze, dream pop, noise rock, and avant rock. I'm going to read from AllMusic Review, Heather Ferris. Isn't Anything was good enough to inspire an entire scene of My Bloody Valentine soundalikes. After two painstaking years in the studio and nearly bankrupting their label, Creation in the process, the group emerged with their masterpiece, which fulfilled all of the promise of their previous albums. If Isn't Anything was the Valentine's sonic blueprint, then Loveless saw those plans fleshed out in the most literal sense. Lumer, What You Want, and To Hear Knows When. Arrangements are so lush, they're practically tangible. With its voluminous yet ethereal melodies and arrangements, Loveless intimates sensuality and sexuality instead of stating them explicitly. Kevin Shields and Belinda Butcher's vocals meld perfectly with the trippy sonics around them, suggesting druggy sex or sexy drugs. The album balances complexity and immediately memorable pop melodies with remarkable self-assurance given its difficult creation. But Loveless doesn't just perfect the group's approach, it also hints at their continued growth. Soon fuses the Valentine's roaring guitars with a dance-inspired beat, while the symphonic interlude touch suggests updated take on Fripp and Eno's pioneering guitar electronic experiments. These glimpses into the band's evolution make Shields' difficulty in delivering a follow-up to Loveless even more frustrating, but completely understandable. The album's perfection sounded shoegazing's death knell and raised expectations for the next My Bloody Valentine album to unreasonable high levels, as My Bloody Valentine fans and apparently Shields himself will attest nothing is as good. All right, what do we think of My Bloody Valentine, Loveless?
First time listen.
Yeah.
Beautiful masterpiece.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yes.
Second that emotion, first time listen, I didn't fucking know. My God.
Longtime fan. Loved it.
Into it.
You knew Birch.
Yeah, man.
You knew Birch and you weren't having us over for druggy sex or sexy drugs.
Dude, look at the guitar on my wall upstairs is a Jazzmaster.
Oh, shit.
Where do you think I got that from?
This was
Sonic Kevin Youth Shields.
And Kevin Shields, yes.
This was the record that marks the first big breakup of my life. Because the guy that was sleeping with my girlfriend at the time was also a friend who brought this record over and hung out with her and listened to it.
Uh-oh.
And I never listened to it myself. So I always had a
stigma on this one.
Yeah, big old stigma, but man, yeah, that's a panty dropper right there. I get it. I get it.
It's thick.
I get it.
Oh my God, this album just... The mystique, the, sounds.
Didn't know nothing about No Mystique.
Wow.
I have no idea what this why this album cost over $200,000 to make.
Yeah.
Well, for one, they recorded it in 19 different studios.
Over basically almost 3 years.
Yeah, that's a good one.
But I think when they talked, you know, like I've read that, you know, in talking with Kevin Shields or whatever, they're like, oh, yeah, it really should have only cost about $40,000 and we knocked it out. If we could have knocked it out, we would have done it in like 4 months. There was just so much stop, start, stop, start, stop, start, okay. Stop, start.
All right. So they're on the side of shit. Are they talking pounds or are they pounds? Pounds. Sterling?
Yes. So pounds 250,000 pounds of 1991 dollars, which is roughly 480,000 pounds of 2021 dollars. I'd say about a half mil, if not more.
Typically, the pound would have been $1 million record.
Yeah. Let's just
Jesus fucking Christ. Yeah. Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Poor Creation Records. They're doing their best. They just had a really big success with Rides Nowhere. They're like, man, finally, we're making some money. Surely this next My Bloody Valentine album will not only be beautiful, but it will have hits we can sell. Three years and the equivalent of $1 million later, yes, it's beautiful. But no, you do not have any hits you can sell. In fact, the band doesn't even want their name on the cover.
Yeah. And isn't this like the label head's dad's money? Or something.
Yeah. Apparently, the dude went gray overnight. Like,
That's pretty stressful. Again, I don't know how spending on records works, but you'd think there'd be a point where you'd be like, no, you can't have any more money.
It is. And he definitely had a nervous breakdown, demanded by the end of it that, you know, Dick Green was the one who had a nervous breakdown, not Alan. But Green recalled, quote, 2 years into the album and I phoned Shields in tears. I was going, you have to deliver me this record. You just have to. Most of it, the mystique, the thing, the recording, Shields said he was not being difficult. It was they were in subpar recording studios and the engineers were not willing to work with him.
Like, the reason this album sounds the way it's, the reason this album's tickling our ears the way it does and no album before it has is because Kevin Shields is breaking rules. You know, like he'd be wanting to do something and these engineers who are trained to make standard records are being like, well, no, like that's not how you do that. That's not, he was going against all of their training, but that was his intent. And he needs to find someone who's going to work with him as opposed to try to convince him to do it in a more standard way.
But how many studios did he have to hop to get to this?
19.
Man, that,
he could have just pulled a guy from Boston and done it all himself.
That guy from Boston's name. Scholes, Tim Scholes?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. He could have just fucking called the Albini up and that would have been fun.
Well, this is
unlike Tim Scholes. Tim Scholes is a... He's a virtuoso musician, and he's also like an electronic maven. Kevin Shields, in his own admission, Kevin Shields when he first started a band didn't know how to make a chord. Kevin Shields, I really want to get into this because I really love this record, and I'm new to it. I'm new to this record as of this week, but the way this record sounds is such a bottom up way of sounding, as opposed to someone writing a record and then putting effects on it top down. Every part of, like, Shields, he's not playing his guitar in a standard way, he's not writing songs in a standard way, he's not using the effects in a standard way, he's not recording it in a standard way. Everything's just coming from his gut as opposed from a knowledge of technique.
Absolutely. I was pleasantly surprised that I had always just assumed that, you know, these were, it was just layers upon layers of effects pedals or something like that, right? Whereas he says, there's not that many effects on this, you know, it kind of has like a few things, but a lot of it's the playing and the way it's recorded. It doesn't rely strictly on those effects pedals to get this just ethereal and different sounds.
Oh, yeah. Sample his it in,
secret,
man.
Yeah, his secret sauce. It's not effects pedals. He obviously he's got some like distortion and reverb, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons that he was using these Fender Jazzmasters is the way the tremolo system works on it, the way the tremolo is rigged up, and the tremolo arm, if you loosen it up, it's long enough that he could hold the tremolo arm while he's strumming. So he's strumming the chords while holding the whammy bar. So the chords, as he's playing, they're just like wobbling. Blah, 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 blah. And like and on his upstroke, they're out of tune. And by the time he goes to his downstroke, they're back in tune. So it has that like warped tape effect on it. And then he pairs that with a reverse reverb effect, which, Birch, can you help me out with this? From my understanding, reverse reverb, that's post-production effect. You need to already have the track recorded to apply reverse reverb, or is there a pedal that can simulate it?
There's a pedal that could do that.
Pedals and rack stuff. Yeah, with the advent of digital, you could do reverse reverb just as a little button push.
Okay.
But it would be instead of a sound that would sort of echo in, it would pull the echo like out.
So yeah.
It's like echoey and then pulled out of every, you know.
He said, you know, playing around with that reverse reverb, playing with it with way it's not intended to be played, trying to make it break, trying to like give it input that it would have trouble making reverse reverb of, either whether he's playing it really hard or playing it really soft. That plus the holding onto the whammy bar while he's strumming was like the secret sauce of his sound.
And of course the alternative tunings.
Yes, alternative tunings.
So it doesn't sound like any other, you know, guitar. You know, you have these
D-A-A-A-A-D.
Yeah. Well, and Ben, you showed us in the chat the little like Fender video about how he does the glide guitar on the tremolo. But he said something during that I thought was really interesting, which is that the way that he's bending the chords and the way he's bringing you back into tune, he plays it such that your brain fills in the right notes. Like if you can look at a set of words in your native language and you take out, you know, a number of the vowels or a number of the consonants, you can still read it because your brain knows what the word's supposed to be. And so to do that musically, I was like, oh, holy shit. No wonder it makes your brain feel so weird when you're listening to those shoegazy walls of whooshing background and then your brain is making its own notes.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
You can do that within, you know, when people play piano, they'll play a note and that note will contain another like sub note like hidden within there. So
the harmonic
that people hear within there. And
even
that's
though it's
really
not being played.
It's not being played.
Oh shit.
But you actually hear another note very, you know, precisely, and that's exactly, you know, why this band, like why this album succeeds is those.
If you hit a C
in between,
the overtone is going to be a G.
Fuck.
Another cool thing that he did to get some of the sounds on this record, he was playing through two amps daisy chained together, and both of these amps had a built-in tremolo, but the tremolos were set to different ratios, like they were out of phase with each other, and they aimed the two amps at each other and put the microphone in the middle. So he's just playing, and you've got both these amps, wah, 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 at different speeds, and the microphone's just picking up the whole thing.
I love it. Love it.
It's so
much.
Cool. Yeah. It's really cool.
It's really similar to what we were talking about with Robert Dimmery 300 years ago, where his assertion that the breaking of what a musical thing is and then using that for a different concept. Similar, maybe not necessarily on the same par as like scratching records was, but yeah, like it's just, you know, just fuck them with shit, like until you get a brand new like sound or idea.
I can, you know, reading his recount of being like, yeah, I mean, they could have gone a little bit faster in things, but just his recount of just being like, no one wanted to work with me how I wanted to do it. I could totally see that happening. He gets in there. He's like, this is how we want to mic it. And they're like, you can't do that. That's not how we mic it. You know, like, and just people fighting him
every step of the way. I cackled earlier, but now I'm kind of.
And I will say he's like partially crazy. You know, he's not like
it depends
losing
on
his mind.
Yeah, if you're an eclectic genius, you're both a genius and fucking eclectic.
Yeah, it really depends on the salesmanship to the producer.
Right.
And if he didn't have the ability to articulate it in a way where they were like, you're a ding dong.
Yeah.
Then yeah, that's what you get. So I'm sorry to jump here. Who ultimately was like, yeah, I can do it.
I'm Kevin Shields is credited as the producer. Like, there's a whole bunch of engineers,
right? You know? And you know, I'll just go through the production here. Creation believed that the album could be recorded in 5 days, according to Shields. And when it became very clear it wasn't going to happen, they freaked. After several unproductive months, the band relocated in September to the basement studio, The Elephant, in Wapping, I guess is what the studio is called, where they spent 8 unproductive weeks. In-house engineer Nick Robbins said Shields made it clear from the outset that Robbins was, quote, just there to press buttons. Robbins was quickly replaced by Harold Burgeon, but according to Shields, Burgeon's main contribution was to show the group how to use the in-studio computer. Burgeon Shields spent 3 weeks at Woodcray Studio in Berkshire working on Glider EP. And that was the other thing. They also worked on 2 EPs because they were taking such a long time for this record because he wasn't getting
something out. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They had to put these other things out. So I think it's a misnomer when people are like, oh, it took such a long time. Like, you know, he never delivered all these things. And, you know, he was delivering EPs and they're good. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you listen to
the
EPs. I
think it's cool that the 2 EPs are called Glider and Tremolo. Where when the glide guitar is played by manipulating the tremolo bar.
Yeah.
I think that's cool. I think that him discovering that, because he didn't own a Jazzmaster, he didn't own a guitar with a tremolo system until he borrowed one in the late 80s. I think that the whole glide guitar system was pretty fresh to him at this point. Yeah. You know?
Mm-hmm. And as nice as we're being about the timing and, you know, people being unjustly harsh, there were a lot of unique things about the recording process that were Kevin Shields, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, he didn't write lyrics all that often. He would sing them and Belinda would try to write down what she thought he said and then she would sing them on top. And they, you know, wouldn't let them really, you know, see them while they're singing unless they pull back a curtain to put up a thumbs up to say that was a good take and, like, so there was a little bit weirdness. And that being said, this album, and again, not to echo Boston, but isn't most of this all Kevin? Like, there's a little bit of Belinda and there's a little bit of Colin McKeesick.
Kevin's playing every stringed instrument on here on this album.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
And a lot of the drums are looped.
Yeah.
Programmed by Kevin.
Yeah. I will slaughter the drummer's name, so I'm just going to call him my drummer Valentine. I think it's him playing, but I think that like Kevin would snag like a sample of him playing and he would just loop that ad hoc.
Yeah. You know? And it sounds pretty natural, except when they want the, like the drum machine sound on like what you want.
Exactly. Yeah. And it works. That's the amazing thing that took me a while to figure out is that first song. When it comes on and it's so stagnant and you can tell immediately, you're like, well, this is a drum machine for sure. Like, it has these just like synthetic style beats, but somehow with the wash over those beats and the way it pops, it's like usually when you have that synthetic tone, it's because someone doesn't have a drummer or they're trying to kind of present this pop music. But this is pop music in a completely different area where it's saying, oh, yeah, we have the pop sensibilities, but behind that pop sensibilities, we have this entire cacophonous wash of swirling sonic elements that are coming forward too.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. It wasn't just the drummer that got looped and sampled. Like it was everything. Like,
oh, a lot of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
They would loop guitars. Oh, yeah.
He would layer his own voice. Yeah. Like you think that it's Belinda singing with him on a couple tracks. No, it's just his voice sped up.
Yeah.
To sound a higher register.
And like a lot of this shit was just sampled in guitar tones played on a keyboard afterwards. Yeah. Pretty incredible. And it was a keyboard sampler they were using. And then no one gave a name to that keyboard sampler. And the only thing that I found was my bloody drummer Valentine.
We can try it. I think it's Column Ocusic.
Yes.
Column Ocusic, maybe.
But it was said on one of the things that it was a Akai S950, but the S950 is a rack. All the Akai S series is a rack. So if it was a keyboard sampler, the only one that existed at this point was the InSonic EPS.
Hmm.
But it's I couldn't find anything that called it out by name. So it could have just been a MIDI controller controlling an Akai S950.
Do any of us own this album?
I own that synthesizer. Sampler. I don't own this album.
Okay.
CD.
Okay, maybe it's somewhere in the notes. But
I really thought I would have found it. But
yeah.
But that's interesting, you know, thinking about how much post-playing, production, engineering, mm-hmm. polishing to make this sound. They went out and they played these songs. Do you know what they would use to hit the really, really high notes?
No.
They hired a flautist. Like, I just thought that, like, that makes a lot of sense. But I can't imagine trying, like, these bands that have such preparation and filtering, like Sonic Youth and My Bloody Valentine, like, playing these songs live must be brutal.
They seem to think that was a proper way to do it, though. To play it live.
Well, and they played it loud, is what I heard.
Yeah, you just got to get it loud enough.
Yeah.
Get all that sustain to carry that reverb.
Yeah, people all over the apparently room. Complained about how loud their concerts were when they were playing live.
I believe it.
Yeah, if you're too loud.
Yeah.
If it's too loud, you're too old.
If it's too loud, you haven't lost enough hearing yet.
Right.
What?
In MA's editor Danny Kelly attended a show he described as, quote, more like torture than entertainment. I had half a pint of lager. They hit their first note and it was so loud that it sent the glass hurling. During the falling US
He threw the glass.
No, it fell out of his hand.
So he dropped
the sonic
it,
blast. Yeah,
he literally was like.
I don't think it was actually the sound waves. I think he dropped his damn beard.
He was just shocked and astonished.
Yeah, at the same time, his monocle fell out.
So many monocles.
During the following U.S. tour, Shields and Butcher tested their audience's ability to sustain noise played at high volumes, according to critic Mark Kemp. After about 30 seconds, the adrenaline set in. People are screaming and shaking their fist. After a minute, you wonder what's going on. After another minute, it's total confusion. The noise starts hurting. The noise continues. After 3 minutes, you begin to take deep breaths. After 4 minutes, a calm takes over.
Yeah, it's like one of those spiky mats. You know, you lay on them and they're like, ah, it sucks. And then you're like, oh, this is great.
Obviously, they got that from, you know, Jesus and Mary Jane.
Yeah. No, the loud.
It was loud.
Single-handedly, the loudest thing I've ever heard was that Nick Cave show. Opening track of that Nick Cave show. Something Street. It sounded like
Street, yeah.
It sounded like a fucking jet engine taking off.
For sure.
I had to put earplugs in. I was not expecting earplugs in the Nick Cave show, but here I am.
Yeah.
Safety 7 first. Years later. What?
Safety second.
Safety what?
Loudest thing I've ever heard was the Indianapolis 500. I was not expecting. I knew it was going to be loud. I was not expecting what it actually was. But yeah, much like the recounts of a My Bloody Valentine show, it's the same thing. Like, like with like the 3 minutes in, you're taking deep breaths, and by 4 minutes in, you've like you've just come to peace with it, and also you've lost some hearing, so it's not as loud anymore. Much like Kevin Shields and Belinda Butcher and Rob Ross, I definitely have tinnitus.
Yeah. So it was. I think it's been confirmed. He basically got, you know, lost some hearing while, you know, mixing, creating this album.
He said just, it was due to headphones.
Yeah. He says that's, you know, not true, but, you know, it probably was. I mean, he can't sustain this forever. He also commented that, you know, the album Shields and Butcher became afflicted with tinnitus. They had to delay recording for further weeks while they recovered. Concerned friends and band members suggested this was a result of the unusually loud volumes the group played at their shows, which Shields dismissed as ill-informed hysteria. Yeah,
sure.
I've got some literature you need to read.
Yeah. Shields also said that the money claimed to have been spent on the album simply was money to live on over 3 years, the album itself only costing a few thousand. He claimed that the album represented only 4 months of work over 2 years, and that most of the money came from the band's own funds, while Creation probably spent £15,000 to £20,000 of their own money on it. That's what he says.
If they were paying hourly for studio time and producers and engineers,
right,
that's not just money to live on. You're paying rent and salary, you know?
Yeah, you're moving equipment from one studio to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next.
Man.
But this band and this album pioneered this sound where you got, like, Smashing Pumpkins, just that androgynous singing over that drone guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the sound of the late 90s.
It's, I will say, I mean, when you hear this album, it's like nothing else.
It literally
is like nothing else.
It's a perfect record, man. Like, and I don't say that lightly.
Yeah.
I don't like that concept, but yeah. There's no fault in any of these songs. Yeah. And it sounds brand new.
Yeah.
To fresh ears, or I mean, I knew of, but I had no clue.
Yeah.
And yeah, just fucking knock my fucking socks off.
Yeah.
I read an interview this week with Billy Corgan, and the interview took place during, during the Melancholy International Tour. Interviews asking Billy Corgan, like, hey, like, what are your influences that, like, led you to this sound? And Billy Corgan just kind of dismissed him. He's like, well, it's just the stuff that you think it probably is, you know, like Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, like, that's what it is. He's like, no one in grunge is doing anything that hasn't already been done sonically with the guitar yet, except for Kevin Shields. He's like, if you've got questions on, on like what's the cutting edge of what you can do with a guitar, don't talk to me. Go talk to Kevin Shields.
Yeah,
nice. Fucking hell.
And
awesome.
I thought that was cool. You know.
Yeah, it's true though. I mean, the you know, we were talking about some other, you know, innovators, but yeah, it's just something about this where you do have the sonic experiment. Sure, you have the, you know, Brian Eno's like pushing it, but it definitely takes someone like to show you the way. And Kevin Shields, for as crazy as it was, you know, to create this album, I mean, it will go down in history as an album that
one of the finest that it's ever been produced.
Pitchfork has called it the best album of the 90s.
Yeah.
I love that, you know, I don't want to call it outsider art, because I don't think it's that. The fact that, you know, Kevin is not coming from a classically trained guitar background. Like, he's coming just from this place of expression, you know, like he's got a sound that he wants to get across, and he's using unconventional means. Yeah. I don't know. I'm just sitting here listening to it at this point.
Do you know who else loved this record? It's Robert Kreisgau. Let me tell you a little story. If you believe the true sound of life on planet Earth is now worse than bombs bursting midair or runway trains, more in the direction of Scalpel Against Bone or the proverbial giant piece of chalk and the accoutrements. This CD transfigures the music of our sphere. Some may cringe at the grotesque distortions they extract from their guitars, others at the soprano murmurs that provide theoretical relief. I didn't much go for either myself, but after suitable suffering and peer support, I learned. In the destructive elements, immerse. A minus.
Mm-hmm. I think the point that I was trying to make was that this album, which is recognized as maybe one of the best albums of the 90s, one of the best albums of rock and roll history, is made in such an unconventional way by going against the flow, by not being a classically trained musician, by not playing the guitar in a way where it's supposed to be played, by not recording something in the way it's supposed to be recorded. You have to break all those rules. And he's not the first person to break those rules, but those rules need to be broken to evolve.
Yeah.
You know, to make something that sounds this new.
Yeah.
It couldn't have come from a conventional musician.
Nope. Yeah, it really took the bankruptcy of creation to create.
Yeah,
got to destroy to create.
Yep. This is the baby that was birthed out of the death of a label.
Yeah, what do you guys think it sounds like? Because I love reading the descriptions of people. Well, I mean, I've always thought like floating, walking underwater.
It's like being super high and surfing.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like sitting in the sun after having two bottles of champagne.
Okay. That's good. Yeah.
Okay. Got any feelings, Ben?
When you're drunk enough that the whole world is moving, but you're not yet at the place where you're falling down, you're just like coasting with it.
Uh-huh.
Before the trouble.
Before the troubles. Before the troubles.
Yeah. Wonderful. Just sounds wonderful all the time. This is what, Robbie, you were asking me, you know, like, what do you get out of Heaven or Las Vegas? Like, Cocteau Twins, like, this is what I get out of it. This, you know, we're listening to, like, Blow Wish right now, and this is, like, Cocteau Twins. This is how he has a bit of the same style of that guitar that doesn't sound like a guitar. It just sounds like a melding. Obviously, this is a bit different. It's a little more rock. You know, it
has also different feeling. There's a very good feasibility that guitar was just sampled in on three different notes and was played on a fucking keyboard.
Right.
Which is fine. Honestly, it's fucking amazing.
It doesn't matter.
They took an Akai S1000 and like were able to fucking make this shit. Ah, it's so fucking cool, man.
Yeah.
And I don't know where Akai was thinking like, oh, we got these wreck samplers and, you know, hip hop exploded around it. And they're like, well, I guess that's one way to use the thing that we made. And then this band comes along and is like, we made a thing. So cool. Right. This, whatever you want to do. I don't know. I'm a Kai.
Yeah.
I love this serendipitous stuff, including it. This is making me think about, you know, the history of the Fender Jazzmaster, which was developed, it was designed and developed for jazz guitarists, and they never took to it. Like, yeah, it was never a popular jazz guitar. It was like the top of the line Fender. It had all the switches, you know, all the toggles.
Three to four. You'd have to shove a fucking, like,
in phase and out of phase. Yeah.
Yeah. You need to put a pencil eraser into it to keep it from fucking moving around if you're thrashing about.
Yeah, but jazz guitarists never took to it. The first like genre to really adopt it was the surf rockers. They definitely found some really cool uses for the Fender Jazzmaster. And then again, it went out of popularity for like a few decades until the late 80s,
mm-hmm,
when these just noisy rock bands are discovering all new uses for it that Fender never intended.
Yeah.
You know, like... I love that stuff.
They're cheap guitars.
Not cheap anymore.
No, definitely not. I did want to talk a little bit about the artwork. Beautiful cover. perfect representation. Obviously, it has the Fender Jazzmaster on it, but it has that like vivid, vivid pink on pink, almost monochromatic sort of look to it. And it is hazy, like a lot of the shoegazing, you know, that would come after it. Just a beautiful cover. I just remember looking at it so much and being like, I think it's a guitar. And then like figuring it out and be like, oh yeah, it's definitely a guitar. And it just having, not even having their name on it. I think it their name is on some of the copies, but you know, just looks just ethereal in a way. The same way like Heaven or Las Vegas kind of had that thing. Obviously, Kevin Shields was happy with this album. He thought it was really good. He did not want to create another album until there was a better album. 2013? 2013, they came out with MBV, the album. So
12 years later? No, 14, math, right?
Wait,
more. No, more no. than that.
More!
2013, yeah.
More!
2022.
From 91 to 2013?
Yeah.
Yeah.
22.
But it was like, that's the crazy thing about Loveless too, the mythos of, you know, okay, they created this album and then no one could live up to it, right? No other band, every band was like, thanks, thank you, My Bloody Valentine, great record, but what are we supposed to do? Like, we cannot compete with this.
Anything else,
Kevin,
man.
Kevin Shields also, he admittedly had a bit of like a Brian Wilson, Sid Barrett episode. You're just like, what do I do after that?
Yeah.
You done did it.
Literally, that's like someone going, thanks Nirvana for reinventing punk rock and hard rock. There's literally anything you can do afterwards. Yeah. That's a dumb idea. But however, I do get like, oh, I spent 3 years making this thing. It's real good. It didn't sell great, but I think I'm all out.
Yeah. You kick the door off the hinge and then you're like, well, now I got to put the door back on. And
I think I'm
go inside the house and make another album. I can't do that.
I think I'm done for a minute.
Yeah.
I can't take it off the hinges anymore. It's already off the hinges.
We have a little lie down.
Whatever the hell is going on in our cans right now, the ba-do-do-ba-do-do. That reminded me a lot of the end of Lou Reed's Berlin.
What you want.
Cool, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, it was rumored, I think it was just a rumor, that some of the names of the songs were named when people would ask him when the new album is coming out. Because you have things like When You Sleep, Sometimes.
Who knows when?
Yeah. Soon.
Coming Alone.
That's great.
Here and Now. Yeah.
There's not really much of a kind of lyric to name a song after. Cause, like, I think Kevin, he's in his demos, he's using the voice as an instrument, not really mattering what he says, and it's mumbly and that low in the mix anyway. And then Belinda is listening to those and just trying to write down what she thinks he says, but she also knows he's not really saying much. This is another reason that this band really vibes with me, because I don't really hear lyrics well. And I don't need to with My Bloody Valentine. I can just be washed over with the tone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something that could sound like a negative was Spin's Jim Greer was like, I recommend the album, but not for the singing or the songs.
Okay. Yeah.
But the other side of that is, no, I like the singing and I love the songs as songs, but but I see what he's saying. It's more the sound.
Yeah.
It's just the sound.
It's the whole thing.
Yeah.
The
whole thing. Yeah.
Traditionally, I mean, when he was mixing it too, I think a lot of the people who were saying, no, you can't put the vocals like where the guitars are, which he does. You know, it's literally like right in the same element of the guitars. Mm-hmm. So you almost have something that you're not quite sure. Is that a guitar now? Is that a singing? Is that, you know, it has like,
it's just another
instrument.
They're not front
in the mix.
No,
yeah.
No, it's buried. Yeah. So yeah. So sometimes every once in a while I will catch myself being like, wait, is that a guitar? Is that a vocal? Like, even though I've heard this, you know, hundreds of times, it's like they're so close. You can imagine it. One more thing. 1992 Guitar World interview, Shields described how he achieved a sound akin to a wah-wah pedal on I Only Said by playing his guitar through an amplifier with a Graphic Equalizer preamp. After recording the track, he bounced it to another track using a parametric equalizer while he adjusted the EQ levels manually. Asked if he could have achieved the effect more easily using a wah-wah pedal, Shields said, in attitude towards sound, yes, but not in approach.
That's such a valid answer. That answer.
Perfect encapsulation.
I love that answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. I think I got all of it.
I think I'm good.
Positive! Yeah. It's one of the best records I've ever heard.
Yep.
Fucking blew my mind. And that hasn't happened that many times on this project.
Yeah.
Yeah, less than a handful.
Yeah, positive over here, dog.
Yeah. Awesome. Total files for me. Amazing. All right, next time we'll be talking about, you guessed it, Nirvana, Nevermind.
Ooh, my flannel!
Put it on, it's cold out.